Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, November 21st, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing wireless broadband infrastructure policy and balancing national priorities. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we're fortunate to have with us our moderator, Gardner H. Foster, who is Senior Counsel, Government Affairs at Sprint. We're thankful that you are here with us, Gardner. The floor is yours until you're ready to take audience questions.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for joining the call today. We have a great panel that will enlighten us on the perspectives on how policymakers balance national priorities with local interests when making broadband infrastructure policy decisions. The Federal Communications Commission currently has an open proceeding on this matter, and there is also heavy activity on both Capitol Hill and in state and local jurisdictions as they struggle to achieve this balance. For today's discussion, each panelist will provide some introductory remarks, and then I'll have a few questions to start the conversation. My intention is to leave plenty of time at the end of the hour to take any questions that the audience may have. Allow me now to introduce the panel. First, we have Jonathan Adelstein, who is the President and CEO of the Wireless Infrastructure Association. WIA represents over 200 companies devoted to building wireless broadband facilities throughout the United States. Jonathan previously served as Commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission from 2002 to 2009. While at the FCC, he achieved bipartisan progress on issues including broadband expansion, widening access to the Internet, and media diversity. Following his time at the FCC, Jonathan served as the Administrator of U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Utility Service and later was appointed as a member of the White House National Science and Technology Council, which coordinates science and technology policy across the federal government. Our next panelist is Rob McDowell, who is partner at the Cooley Law Firm and also serves as Chief Public Policy Advisor to Mobile Future. In his practice, Rob advises telecommunications, media, and technology clients on their most significant regulatory, legal, and business matters. Rob is also a former commissioner of the FCC, and served from 2006 to 2013, where he was at the forefront of resolving several complex and groundbreaking issues facing the telecommunications industry. Prior to the FCC, Rob was Senior Vice President for CompTel, the Competitive Telecommunications Association, where he led advocacy efforts before several government agencies, the White House, and Congress. Finally, we have Brad Ramsey, who is General Counsel of the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners. Founded in 1889, NARUC is a nonprofit organization dedicated to representing the state public service commissions who regulate the utilities that provide essential services such as energy, telecommunications, power, water, and transportation. Brad is responsible for all association-related legal issues and for managing the policy department for policy, regulatory, and legislative matters, including its Committee on Critical Infrastructure. Brad has worked at NARUC in a variety of senior positions since 1990. And with that, Brad, since I introduced you last, I'll let you start us off.
Well, in terms of the FCC, you know, the best you can say about the proceedings, the absolute best you can say about the proceedings are they're premature. NARUC did support the idea of the Broadband Deployment Advisory Council as an idea of facilitating state action by providing best practices for various jurisdictions, the state and local level to look at. But the fact is, the two proceedings, the wireline and the wireless proceeding pending before the FCC, there's no record, there's no authority, and broad preemptive action simply makes no sense. If you're interested in expanding the size of federal agencies, if you're interested in expanding the power of the FCC in this area, and ultimately creating additional court precedent for future FCCs to exploit, you should be in favor of quick action on both the NPRM and the NOIs in these two dockets. I agree pretty much with Justice Gorsuch's statement in an opinion he wrote when he was still at the Tenth Circuit, the Gutierrez versus Lynch, said the fact is that Chevron and Brand X permit executive bureaucracies to swallow huge amounts of core judicial and legislative power and concentrate federal power in a way that seems more than a little difficult to square with the Constitution of the framers' design. There was the Energy Bar. I'm also a member of the Energy Bar Association. They issued their Bar Association Law Review articles today, and they had a big, long article on Chevron. And they, too, also used as an example, basically, of Chevron abuse, Brand X, and they called it a classic example where deference enabled multiple subsequent agency flip-flops. These two proceedings are setting the stage for, in my view, Brand X Part 2, or actually more accurately, in my view, Brand X Part 4. To paraphrase, you know, Randy May put out a press release this morning talking about the open Ninet order. I like what he said. I'll adapt it to this proceeding. This is what he said, slightly changed. Even if I were to agree that the proposed regulations were sound as a matter of policy, and I don't, the FCC must still ground them in lawful authority. In other words, it's up to Congress to grant the FCC authority if it wishes to do so, not for the commission to arrogate authority to itself. It's not what happens here. The FCC is relying on four provisions in the statute. They're all phrased in terms of telecommunications. So at the outset, you have to look at telecommunication services. At the outset, you have to look at the fact that the commission is getting ready to reclassify at least BIAS services as an information service, and it has consistently refused for the last 13 years to classify the other likely service to be flowing over these connections, that is, voice over IP. So there's no real, after the end of this proceeding, if it goes in the direction that the chairman wishes it to go, none of these provisions will apply on their face. But even if they did apply on their face, if you look at 332C7BI2, that only deals with zoning decisions, individual zoning and land use. It doesn't mention rights of way. It doesn't mention fees. It doesn't mention polls. And there is, if you read that correctly, and as I think the FCC in an earlier decision did, there's no deemed granted option associated with that. You have to go to district court in terms of the poll attachment statute, section 224. If you look at that, does that give them authority to do all of this with respect to cities and localities? Well, 224 and the commission's authority over poll attachments is limited to utilities. And if you look at the definition of utilities in 224A, you'll see the utility doesn't include any person that's cooperatively organized. That means co-ops, electric and telecom co-ops. It also doesn't include any person owned by a federal government or a state. So that doesn't provide a lot of source authority, at least with dealing with state rights of way or even polls owned by cities or states. 253, same thing. It's very specific in 253C. It specifies that nothing in 253 affects the authority of a state to manage public rights of way or to require fair and reasonable compensation as long as they do it on a competitively neutral basis. It makes clear the probably the most important thing about that one is that reservation of authority is in 253C, and the FCC has no – I'm sorry that somebody's dialing in on my phone. The FCC lacks authority to do anything in that respect. It basically has to go to district court. If you look at 253D, the FCC's jurisdiction to impact provisions that may prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting any telecommunications provider from providing a telecommunications service, it is limited to its authority under Part A and Part B, not Part C. So you're basically stuck with from 253, the authority to the extent that it would apply, you'd end up going to court. You wouldn't be looking at FCC rulemaking. Finally, they rely on the Spectrum Act, 1455, which deals only in areas where a company has facilities in place, and it also, again, doesn't mention anything about compensation except for federally owned facilities. And it talks just about changes to wireless emplacements that change the size and dimensions. And anyway, in any case, as I think was mentioned in the introduction, it's pretty clear I'm not the only one that thinks that the FCC lacks authority here. It is not a coincidence that Congress, as we speak, is considering, or at least in the Senate, they've now circulated a little draft, to buttress the FCC's, well, the obvious gaps in the FCC's authority to proceed in these particular, based on these four provisions. But I've always believed, and I continue to believe this day, I actually, back in the Brand X days, I talked to my friends in Chairman Powell's office about this. From a policy perspective, pursuing obviously distorted constructions of a clear statutory text is really a bad idea. The FCC's past successes in Brand X, the decision on CALEA, the Tenth Circuit support of the FCC's so-called 2011 transformation order provided tons of legal precedent that the 1996 Act doesn't place any real limits on the agency's authority to either regulate or deregulate. And the fact is, as logic in history since 1996, or at least since Brand X, demonstrates, every time the FCC successfully expands its authority beyond the plain text of the statute, results in less long-term certainty for legal rules and regulations that will be applied by a future FCC. And you have an example in the announcement that's being made, well, that was made today, but the text of the decision is not coming out until tomorrow on, again, the FCC's classification of biased service. But even if the FCC did have authority, if you look at the record, and I've always had interesting views, I guess, of the record based on where I went to law school. If you look at the record, I don't think that there's a statistical record there to justify FCC intervention. In fact, given the current stage in 5G deployment so far, I think it's unlikely that you could compile sufficient evidence to demonstrate a widespread problem exists. And what do you know? What do we know right now? So far, the wireless tower industry has, under current laws, I researched a little bit of this before I filed my first set of comments, found three analysts that said, oh, this industry is growing rapidly. It's true the record reflects a large number of additional sites will be needed, but other than a few anecdotes, if you look at the actual pleadings, there's not any statistical data there. The motility petition that was filed and started this whole mess, this was the evidence that was in their original petition. They listed six or seven cities, including Los Angeles, where they had no problem rolling things out, and then they said, but we have had problems in other areas. That isn't statistical or even – that isn't a record for FCC action. Anecdotal descriptions of flawed or stalled initial rollouts, the fact that some areas of the country would be more receptive than others shouldn't be a surprise or at this stage constitute the justification for intervention. So far, there's little in the record illustrating anything other than a utility has to pay for access for rights of way owned by the public, and that different configurations and placements in different communities have different prices. If you given the wide difference in property values and tax bases among communities, that's what you would expect. Absent a much stronger factual showing, any free market advocate or federal entity charged in part with protecting the public interest should tread carefully. This is particularly true in the circumstances presented where the FCC concedes in one of the NPRMs, as Congress did in enacting 253 and 332, that localities play an important role in preserving local interests such as aesthetics and safety, and also that rights of way have always served the public interest by enabling citizens to obtain essential services, including electricity, telephone, gas, water, and transportation. So rights of ways are used for many things, and the ongoing provision of the crucial services that they're utilized for requires a really detailed review for both cell tower and wireless telecommunications facilities to assure that they will not raise safety or reliability concerns. Consider that the FCC can't step in. This is, I guess, my last little point is, it kind of annoys me that the industry is all coming in and saying across the board for rights of way use, it has to be limited to actual costs, and you can't actually, you can't do any rent seeking on publicly owned property. And you have to consider the fact that the FCC can't tell Crown Castle what it can charge to allow colocation on his tower. The FCC can't tell a private landowner what compensation he or she must take to allow a tower company to use his or her land. And for the same reason, the FCC should hesitate before telling elected officials that the citizens that voted them into office must subsidize specific uses of their property via an FCC mandate. Those decisions should continue to be met locally by elected officials with demonstrated unique expertise and knowledge relative to the management of their own rights of way as guardian and trustee for their citizens, not by an agency thousands of miles away, no knowledge, expertise, or significantly accountability to local and voting citizens.
Thank you very much, Brad. We appreciate your initial comments, and I would ask Rob now to either respond to what Brad just said or present a consistent or alternative perspective on either the FCC proceeding or what's going on broadly on infrastructure policy.
Sure. Thank you, Gardner, and it was great to run into you yesterday, and great to be on this call with so many distinguished presenters, including Brad Ramsey, who just always makes an eloquent presentation, and my old partner in crime, Commissioner Adelstein. So I'm going to refer to him many, many times. So let me take a step back and sort of talk about what's sort of at stake. And when we're talking about infrastructure, and there's going to be a lot of discussion in the coming months about infrastructure writ large. And I don't think any segment of the American economy is more important than the wireless infrastructure. So over the next 7 years or so, you're going to need nearly $300 billion in new investment as mobile companies and tower companies and all the rest upgrade our infrastructure to build out 5G networks. 5G, by the way, will be 100 times faster than 4G. And it could boost, 5G alone could boost our GDP by $500 billion and create about 3 million new jobs. It's important, by the way, that the U.S. maintain its competitiveness as it builds out these 5G networks and everything that's going to be related to the Internet of Things and the incredible the saturation of connectivity we're going to have as a result. We have Asia and China specifically racing to try to beat us with standards in 5G and to dominate the equipment in that market, as well as maybe the services, including apps and, you know, algorithmic-based technologies. And so if we want to continue our leadership in the mobile Internet, as we did with the race to 4G, we beat the rest of the world there, we're going to need to make sure we streamline any barriers to investment. So let me give a little bit of a historical context to that. So Jonathan, Commissioner Adelstein, and I served for many years together and worked extremely well together. When you read about the lack of bipartisanship, it worked well on some deregulatory matters. So for instance, the video franchising order, Jonathan, I think that was in December of 06, maybe it was 07. It's kind of a blur at this point. You can correct me when you speak. The cell tower order that we did, I think that was after you had left, but was a bipartisan effort under Chairman Jenikowski. The USF, the Universal Service Fund Subsidy Reformation Order under 2011. All of the, and then back to when Jonathan was on board, the Title I classification orders of the different forms of broadband had bipartisan votes without dissent. And why is that important? Well, each of those contained some preemption of states and localities. If you look at video franchising or the cell tower order or the Title I classification was a different bucket, which I'll get to in a minute. But the states were not steamrolled. I know Brad's going to disagree with that. But it wasn't as if the feds came in and said, we're the only game in town, federal and or state and local authorities don't have any jurisdiction here. But it did set up shot clocks and tried to eliminate unnecessary barriers. So hopefully states and localities will look at the massive investment that's going to go on over the next decade into 5G and the Internet of Things as an economic development opportunity and not as just an opportunity to charge, in some cases, exorbitant fees. There are taxpayer-owned poles, for instance, and rights of way, where in some cases localities are charging outrageous fees, which ultimately means that those communities are not going to get the upgrades. So Brad made a very eloquent defense of states' rights and small government. But what we want to make sure doesn't happen is that the states become federal governments of their own. So the danger here, and part of what I'm working on this week, is the preemption part of the Restoring Internet Freedom Order, just so you know, Brad. We could talk about that later if you want. But is to make sure that in the absence of federal rules, the states and localities don't just jump in and start regulating like little countries, and you're going to end up with a balkanization or splintering of internet regulation. You know, it'll be an inconsistent, complex patchwork quilt of regulations, which then totally we just hang ourselves, and we'll have innovation investment slow down to a crawl or just grind to a halt altogether. That's part of the balance here. And as I look, for instance, at the video franchising order back a decade ago, We had to balance what is the state role, what's the appropriate state role in something right now that is, and right now when we leap to mobile, it's inherently interstate in nature. When you're talking about the mobile internet, your packets and your device are being routed all over the world, really, let alone in an interstate fashion. And so it's very different from the old POTS days when you had, a copper wire going from your house to a central office in town, you know, across the state to another part of the state, et cetera. That's not how packet switching works. Voice communications, email, video, whatever, all get chopped up in little pieces and routed all over the place in the most efficient way possible, the way the TCP/IP protocol dictates. So it's inherently interstate in nature. And that's the balance the FCC has to try to strike. But when you look at the appeals of the video franchise order, the cell tower order, the universal service reform in 2011, or the classification of cable modem under Title I, which went to the Supreme Court, Brad cited the Brand X case, in all of those cases, there were states' rights issues raised, and in all those cases, the FCC succeeded because more and more of these issues are clearly interstate in nature. Brad is correct to point out, though, you can sow the seeds of more federal involvement the way the Wheeler FCC did in the second Obama term, tried to preempt state legislatures from prohibiting localities from getting into the broadband business. So there's some states like Tennessee that passed state laws saying that the cities and towns and counties of Tennessee could not use taxpayer money to build out municipally owned and operated broadband networks and companies, essentially. This is different. That's the political process that is talking about state tax dollars. Do states have the authority to regulate their subdivisions? And they do, and the courts ruled against the FCC in that case. What we're doing here is, or what they hopefully, I think, I speak with a fair amount of confidence that Ajit Pai and Commissioner O'Reilly and Commissioner Carr, at a minimum, are going to try to use federal authority to streamline barriers to entry, regulatory barriers to entry, to ensure that we can get the proper investment out there so that states aren't popping up as little FCCs trying to get in the way of things, while at the same time preserving state autonomy and state sovereignty in accordance with the law as it has before. So for sure, all these orders that are coming out will be appealed. There'll be a states' rights angle to some of the appeals. I'm confident that you've got some excellent lawyers, starting with the chairman himself, who will be reviewing these to make sure that they're going to survive on appeal. But let's keep our eye on the big prize here, and that is upgrading our wireless infrastructure so that we can remain competitive, so that we can serve consumers well. And this isn't about localities or states just getting a shakedown in fees. It's about growing the economic pie overall, which will help the states and localities as their economies grow. So I'll leave it at that for now, Gardner, and looking forward to Jonathan's presentation and then Q&A. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Rob, for Commissioner McDowell, for putting everything in perspective. We did make a lot of progress together. We were on the FCC, and we worked with Brad Ramsey quite a bit and got things done in conjunction with NARUC on many occasions as well. And I think we should be able to move forward here. Brad seems a little bit stuck in his ways on this issue, but I'm sure we can bring him around by getting him to reread 253 and 332 and realize that, in fact, there's ample authority for the FCC to ensure that states are complying with those provisions that prevent them from prohibiting service. Of course, the law doesn't say deemed granted, but it gives the broad authority to ensure that state or local laws don't prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting the ability to provide telecommunications service. So our job is to try to figure out, what does that mean? What does that grant of authority mean? And I think, Rob, you put it in perspective well when you stepped back for a minute and talked about 5G. This is something that states and localities want for themselves. It's something that the industry, as you've noted, is prepared to invest massive sums, as much as $300 billion, which would have a profound effect on the economy. But as promising as 5G is, it's only as good as the infrastructure on which it's deployed. Rob, you mentioned that it's going to be 100 times faster, but that also requires 100 times or up to 100 times more antennas. So this is a whole new world that we're in. This is a world where we have to put out a lot of new equipment in a very short period of time at a very high cost at a time when the industry is really under stress. Prices are under pressure because of intense competition. Average revenue per user is going down even as users are getting much more data for the same money. So consumers are doing very well, but the industry is in a squeeze when it's trying to invest these kind of sums. So how do we get it done? I think the key is responsible infrastructure deployment. And going back to what Brad was talking about, we in our industry want to work very closely with local governments and communities. In fact, we built a world-class wireless network, the envy of the world, and all of these installations have been approved by localities. So we are great partners together, and we need to continue to go that way. You know, if a company carelessly circumvents a locality, it really angers the community. And that can create resistance to siting new wireless facilities. That slows down 5G. So WIA and our members seek to work with localities very closely in partnership because that's the best way to develop networks over the long term. And when it comes to this issue of what does prohibition on service mean, this really isn't something that applies broadly to localities because many communities, an increasing number of communities, welcome wireless deployments with open arms, with streamlined siting policies. They roll out the red carpet and say, we want more wireless broadband in our community. How can we help? I was just at a meeting in my home town of Arlington, Virginia, with their involved the CIO, just as a local deal. I went to speak with them, and they're trying to figure out how can we get ahead? What can we do? How can we make it easier to deploy wireless? That's what the smart communities are doing, because smart communities require smart regulation. What Congress tried to do is to make sure that all localities do that. I think what the FCC is trying to do is to implement Congress's vision to bring all communities up to the same high standard by speeding the approval of permits and applications. Now, you know, there's some very important proceedings that are going on that you've both spoken about. And just to think about these proceedings, you know, they're designed to lower barriers to wireless infrastructure deployment. And they are really necessary. Brad said there's no evidence. There is voluminous evidence in the record of significant delays, unclear and inconsistently applied local processes, all kinds of burdensome requirements and limitations, moratoria, and arbitrary and exorbitant fees when our companies are trying to site these facilities. And again, that's not all communities, but we're talking about what do we do with those that are basically flouting the requirement of the Communications Act to facilitate these deployments and not prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting service. So to get down to the basics, you know, what we think that means, we're asking the FCC to issue a declaratory ruling that reconciles inconsistent interpretations and enforcement of Section 253A by clarifying that it isn't limited to just an outright prohibition on service, but by any state or local requirement that doesn't treat competitors or different technologies equitably or with competitive neutrality, or requirements that give local governments total discretion over applications and imposing lengthy or onerous application processes. That can have the effect of prohibiting telecommunications services too. And we think there should be a 60-day shot clock for applications to install small cells. And in the end, there should be a deemed granted remedy. Yeah, it doesn't say deemed granted in 253A, but it gives the idea that you can't just deny these or let them be in limbo forever because that has the effect of prohibiting service. So, you know, going to court isn't always a great option. It takes a long time, and we'd like to see the FCC give a more rapid and efficient answer to it. You know, so we have a lot. I could get into detail. I don't want to bore everybody on this call with what we are looking for. There's a wireline MPRM too, which is critical because wireline service is critical to providing 5G. 5G will require fiber connections to every antenna, or virtually every antenna if there's not a really robust wireless backhaul. So we are pleased that they're looking at ways to improve the procedures for the historic preservation, environmental review. And they're also dealing with tribal issues. Now, when we talk about tribal issues, we're finding a whole new issue. This isn't talking about siting on tribal lands, but tribes are going far outside their historic areas and requiring lengthy reviews by not really looking into things, asking for fees in areas where they were never involved. That's something that we've asked the FCC to fix, and we're seeing some real progress on that. So, you know, that's why we're engaged in this process. You know, we want to work with localities, and if localities aren't causing all kinds of delays and problems, I don't see why they should be concerned about this. I mean, what's the issue here if everybody's making the progress that, you know, that some localities say they're making? It shouldn't apply to them. It should only apply to those that are dragging their heels, not processing these things in an efficient manner, throwing up all kinds of unreasonable obstacles. In terms of working with localities, as long as they're reasonable, we're really looking forward to working with them and getting it done. And we've done that, and we do that by and large with many communities. But for those that aren't doing that, that are recalcitrant, they essentially are having the effect of prohibiting service in their communities, which is a real tragic outcome, because it means our industry can't invest in those communities. It means those communities are denied the benefits of wireless broadband and all of the wonderful educational opportunities and healthcare opportunities and economic development that comes with them. So the Congress wisely asked the FCC to try to ensure that this rolls out in a reasonable and timely fashion. And so we look forward to working with the commission and, of course, with Brad and all the representatives of localities to try to reach as much consensus as we can and move the ball forward. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, Gardner.
Can I say anything, or is that?
No, you can't, Brad. That's it.
Preemption. Who's moderator? Can I raise my virtual hand or no? I'm not hearing
Gardner.
Yeah,
Gardner, do you have your mic on mute?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay.
Well,
wonderful.
Know, Brad, why don't you go ahead, Brad? You ought to just let us know what you think. You always do, so I'm joking.
Oh,
go ahead.
Just going back to, there is a policy case for some sort of streamlining at the state level, and I am of the view that at this particular stage, the best way is to see how things develop. You've acknowledged that a lot of states and communities are welcome them, and both you and Rob suggested that the outcome, if they don't comply, is the state doesn't get the service. My problem is that the statute, if you read the actual statute, in 253, you keep going to 253A, Jonathan, and talk about, I agree, it says no state or local statute can prohibit any telecommunication service provider from providing any telecommunication service. I agree it says that, but Section C says nothing in this section, including the section I just read, affects the authority of a state local government to manage rights of way or to require fair or reasonable compensation from telecommunications providers on a competitively neutral and non-discriminatory basis. And this actually, 253 doesn't really address wireless. Wireless siting facilities is excluded. If you look at 253C, it kind of references you to the 332 paradigm. I'd love to talk about deemed granted, but that's another probably 15 minutes to talk about why, even from a constitutional perspective and from a case law perspective, FCC and federal case law, that makes no sense. But my problem is not so much with the policy that is being pursued, is with the fact that Congress did not give the FCC this authority, and it's pretty clear on the face of all four of the provisions that are cited. And the other thing that you said, Jonathan, that I can't completely disagree with, because I confess I've only gotten through about one-fourth of the comments that were filed, but I will say the few that I've found that cite instances of open quote egregious close quote state action or state or locality action are along the lines of Crown Castle filed an ex parte. You know, I started with the most recent and was working my way back. Crown Castle was the first one I found that had three examples, and one of their examples that sticks in my mind was they're talking about they're litigating the San Francisco regulations since 2011, and they won't get it done until 2019. And then if you look at San Francisco's comments in the proceeding, San Francisco says that they've allowed access to 26,000 polls that they own and that they have procedures in place for other places. What I get from that in terms of record evidence is Crown Castle doesn't like the procedures and doesn't like the fees associated with the procedures, but they didn't provide record evidence, or at least unequivocal record evidence, that there's any need for federal intervention, and that has been typical. I can give you another example. There was a filing by this was one of the follow-up questions we were expecting to receive. I can't remember the name of the group, but I looked at it because I was curious. It's like, oh, Commissioner O'Reilly looked at this one filing and said, if you look at this filing, you see immediately why we have to intervene. Well, I looked at the filing. And the filing, if you look at it, it lists 44 jurisdictions in Florida that impose moratoriums in Part A. In Part B, presumably, they include the most egregious moratorium to put in full text in their addendum. And that one is from, I can't remember the name of the city, but basically what it is Florida passed a statute in July, and the city put a moratorium in August that would last to the end of the year so they could revamp their regulations. If that's the most egregious example they could find of the moratorium, I'm wondering what the other 44 jurisdictions in the state of Florida are doing. I'm betting they're probably all revising their laws. And Part C was, again, citing an egregious, I'm presuming it was the most egregious example of local rules implementing the Florida statute that they could come up with. They got theirs done by September. They had a short-term moratorium and got theirs done by September. And I looked through it for egregious examples. Now, I probably didn't look at all of the places, but most of it was taken up with indemnification requirements, requirements for bonding and insurance. I didn't see anything that jumped off the page as particularly egregious. So when you say that there are tons of – there may be, because I haven't gotten all the way through, so I can't speak across the board yet. But I'm working my way through pretty slowly through all of the comments. And so far, I haven't run across any really – hugely egregious examples. The ones that I hear anecdotally about when I'm on these calls are somebody charging like $7,000, and I think that goes back to the tribal authorities who want historic review of tribal lands, and I'm not qualified to comment on whether that's a reasonable expenditure or not. Sounds unreasonable on its face, but I don't know the details, and that seems to be the problem with most of the examples that I've run across in the record so far.
Well, Brad, maybe I can help you out here a little bit. I'll give you a jump start so you don't have to read all of it. I'll give you some summaries here. Our local members report that on a local level, 70% of applications to place small cells in the right-of-way during a two-year period exceeded the 90-day shot clock, and 47% exceeded the 150-day shot clock for the construction of new towers. Another reports that wireless siting process exceeds 90 days more than a third of the time in a third of the jurisdictions and exceeds 150 days in a quarter of them. One city in the suburbs of Seattle requires a $5,000 fee for it. It'll even begin to review a required agreement, and a Virginia city wants a similar one-time fee. One Massachusetts city wants $6,000 per pole for the right to use public row and, you know, the rights of way. This would, if you look at that example, they wanted 50 facilities in this Massachusetts city, and that would be a $300,000 annual fee for 50 small wireless facilities. It kills the whole business case. So that city can kiss its wireless goodbye. It's not going to get it. Our industry will just go somewhere else. You know, maybe they like that. Maybe they think that's worth it. But I think it's a tax on broadband that really undercuts their community.
Another argument might be, and here's something I don't know the answer to, because I will agree that on its face, that particular charge seems a little high to me. I'm not an expert in these areas, but I wonder – you know, it does seem to me, looking at some of these, we had some people come out to Nehruk, two people from an electric company come out to Nehruk, and tell us all about this stuff. And my big question there, and this was in the context of pole attachments where they're and a utility, where the FCC actually does have authority. And I was asking them, they had two people to handle all of the management for all of their facilities in the city of Baltimore, and it was all of the stuff that goes on with pole attachments. And the attitude there was, yes, but you have to prioritize the stuff that is for the broadband people. You know, all the other stuff, the public safety stuff, the smart city stuff that you're looking at, no, you know, you got to, the first person you've got to help is this pole attachment person. I have a question for you. Are you saying that you cited they missed the 90-day shot clock? Or were you
right,
suggesting that they're – is there
a 70% of them miss the 90-day shot clock, so they're not following it. You know,
there is a 90-day shot clock, and you're saying they miss it.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, my question is, if they're missing the 90-day shot clock, what exactly is it you think that the FCC is going to do? Oh, you think that the FCC should say, I'm just trying to follow the argument here. It's like you're saying, well, they're missing the current regulations that the FCC does have the authority to impose on zoning applications, which, by the way, if you look at the case law, the shot clocks you're referring to come under Section 332. That section only deals with zoning, and it never, none of the case law, even the case law cited by the FCC in the proceeding, deals with rights of way. They deal with handling a zoning application. Rights of way are owned by the city. None of the case law applies when it's owned by the city. So those, if to the extent that they're giving you something in the rights of way and it's not being treated as a zoning issue, there wouldn't be a shot clock that did apply. And in terms of deemed granted in the context of a wireless facility is directly counter to the instruction in Section 332 I-2 that if you have a disagreement and this does not occur within the time frame, that you have to go to federal court. You know, if Congress says you have to go to federal court, the FCC can't say deemed granted. That makes absolutely no sense.
Say that. I mean, Congress didn't say you have to go to federal court. That's one remedy now. The FCC is debating whether if you've got all these communities dragging things on, it's very difficult for our members to take a locality to federal court. And the reason is they want to work in partnership because if you don't get it done in a certain area, they'll get you somewhere else. I mean, local governments ultimately own a lot of power that they can use over our members. So they basically let it drag out. And going to federal court takes a long period of time. It's very confrontational, not a great remedy. And, you know, these are zoning applications. They might be in the rights of way, but they still, I think, apply under the authority that the FCC has for zoning. So you can't have it both ways. They take it to federal court and they don't have jurisdiction. I mean, I think that we'd rather work it out. And if they can't get it done in a timely fashion, and we talked about moratoria too, localities in California and Iowa and Minnesota issued indefinite moratoria in August 2016. Prohibiting new wireless and small cell facilities. And de facto moratoria have been imposed across all kinds of jurisdictions in Massachusetts and Illinois, and there's a lot of examples of that in the record. It's just that's a prohibition on service if ever there was one. I don't care what the reason is. They got to revamp their statute or whatever. They ought to be processing things in the meantime under some type of interim rule or using existing rules but making it within the time frame that's contemplated, because otherwise they're just prohibiting service, and that's a pretty clear violation of 332 and 253. So, anyway,
if a moratorium on rights of way, then I would tend to disagree with you. If it's a moratorium generally, then I'd want to know the details and why, and maybe you can make a case. Moratorium is, you know, I can concede some instances where that would fall within the FCC's authority under the statute. I'm not sure if the particular instances you're citing are in that category, but I can concede that legally there's definitely an argument there for that, but not for it depends on the scope of the moratoria and you know, if they're talking about we're just shutting down everything in the rights of way for a temporary period and they've got a good reason for it, that's owned by the city. The FCC cannot force the FCC can't force you to put a tower in your backyard. They don't have the authority to do that. They don't. The city owns the rights of way. If they are putting their zoning so that they allow competing services in the same rights of way, then you have an argument, because the statute actually, you know, you were saying we just want them to be competitively neutral and apply. Well, the statute requires that with respect to rights of way. They have to post the cost of the reasonable compensation, and they have to provide reasonably, you know, competitively neutral access. So that's already in the statute. That's there. But this broad, if you look at the overall scope of what the FCC is trying to do, I just don't agree. I hear the case that you're making, but what I don't hear, and now I'm hoping that you can send me the sites to those pleadings so I can see if I can get behind them and find out what's going on. And I confess, I may agree with you in some cases, particularly with moratoria, that there's a case to be made. But for much of what I've seen so far, and I haven't gotten that far down, I haven't seen the case. And what's always missing in these circumstances is the other half of, you know, the other half of the equation. There was another one, I think it was in Crown Castle too. They were talking about a town in Maryland, and the first thing I did was look it up. The city had delayed acting on their process for like 5 months. And what I saw, because I just searched in Google under news, was there was a couple of huge town council meetings that was attended by a whole lot of people. And it made a lot of big splash in the press because people weren't really interested in seeing, you know, they had photographs and pictures in the newspaper account of the less small version of the attachments to the utility poles. You know, the refrigerator-sized things are sitting in the middle of the telephone pole that attracted a lot of attention. Now, that may be few and far in between where those have to be attached, but there was a lot of uproar associated with it. So I would like to investigate that further before I even thought that was an example of where the FCC should intervene. Seems like this
Hey, Brad, sorry, it's Gardner. I wanted to interject because we're at the 45-minute mark. I wanted to give Rob McDowell a chance to jump in here and offer his perspective on what we've heard in the debate between you and Jonathan and talk just for a couple minutes because I want to give the audience an opportunity to ask some questions of the panel. If Rob could just give, you know, 2 minutes on what he's heard here and in the context of the recent order that the commission just adopted, what he thinks the commission got right and what he thinks maybe the commission could have gone a little farther on.
Yeah, and real quick, I apologize to everyone. I'd love to open this up to Q&A because I'm going to have to jump off and I have to run across town a little bit early before 4 o'clock. So, you know, there's a lot of back and forth, and you know, Brad has certainly done a very good job of making his case. And a lot of these arguments have been raised in other proceedings, similar proceedings, and appellate courts have not necessarily looked favorably upon them. So it all depends on context, of course. You know, we need to just overall the global issue here is to make sure that these networks can be built without unnecessary interference from states and localities. That's really what it's all about, and while still preserving state sovereignty. You know, I think there's a lot of model state legislation that's been helpful. I know Jonathan and I were working on that a couple years ago, and that is being rolled out and is helpful in some regards. So I think you'll see a lot of actually bipartisan agreement coming out of the FCC anyway on some of these orders because historically we always have, and wireless issues in particular and those ancillary issues related to the deployment of wireless have long been areas where we've found great bipartisan agreement, as I tried to say at the beginning of the call. But Gardner, I'm happy to go ahead and open this up to Q&A, because I'm going to have to jump off in about 5 minutes, so I apologize.
Thanks, Rob. And if the Federal Society folks could open up the bridge for others and take questions.
Of course. Let's move to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone keypad. The queue is currently open. Is there anything that you'd like to ask, Gardner, that hasn't already been covered?
I think we've covered a lot of the questions that I had circulated to the group earlier. Perhaps, Jonathan, if you could, you know, if I hate to put you on the spot on this, but is there a particular jurisdiction where your clients, the folks you represent, have noticed some real problems with how the jurisdiction handles these infrastructure policy decisions, and you know, maybe give a concrete example of what's going wrong out there in the country?
Sure. Well, you know, we hate to call out individual communities. One of the reasons Brad noted that there isn't necessarily a lot of names in there is that, as I indicated, we need to go back these communities again and again for more permits. But I gave a lot of examples of barriers that, you know, cities are asking for large fees or, you know, what's happening in certain states that I noted. But let me just talk about something positive that's happening in states, since we're trying to keep this all, you know, looking at what can be done together. 13 states in the last year or so have passed laws that provide deemed granted remedies and provide access to the road that's expedited and provide reasonable fees. So state legislatures themselves are seeing the need for this. 13 states, including some of the largest in the country, such as Texas, have enacted these laws in Florida. So we're not really saying, you know, anything that the states aren't saying for themselves. They recognize the need for broadband infrastructure investment. They recognize that some of the localities in their communities are dragging their heels, and they have stepped up to enact laws to do what it is we're asking the FCC to do. And then the debate here is about whether the FCC has the authority to do it. Sometimes it's easier, and the industry goes to state legislatures because the authority then is created by the state legislature, and localities derive their ability to come up with zoning and land use law based on state law. So that's sort of the final word on it. We don't have to have a debate about the meaning of 253 and 332 because the state law is the final word on it. And states are speaking in droves, and we expect a number of additional states to take action in the coming year.
Thanks for that. Are there any questions from the audience?
There are no current questions in the queue. Again, audience members, if you'd like to ask a question before this call ends, enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. I will say, before we move on to more discussion, that our next Teleform call is scheduled for November 28th, and it will be titled Courthouse Steps, Digital Realty Trust, Inc. v. Somers, discussing the oral arguments on said case. Looks like we do have one question from the audience. Let's move to our first audience question.
First, let me thank you fellows and the Federalist Society for a really interesting discussion. I don't know much about it, but I have a real challenge in getting decent internet access in a small community out in Southwest Colorado. And there are a lot of little providers, kind of mom-and-pop shops, that would like to do it, but population density has kind of kept them from doing it. How does that figure in? I mean, I know there are a lot of big players that we're talking about when we talk $300 billion investments, but what about the hurdles that are in the way of the little tiny people that are trying to extend in a small rural area?
Well, that's a good question. You know, this is Jonathan Adelstein here. Every dime that goes to unnecessary regulation and exorbitant fees is a dime that can't be invested in rural broadband. And there is an issue there because the market makes it difficult. The economics of getting to rural areas is more challenging. And there's a lot of capital being allocated for this purpose, but there's not unlimited amount of capital. And so we're trying to facilitate the rural build-out. We think it's critical that get out there. And I think uniform cell siting legislation or regulation would facilitate build-out in rural areas. Rural areas tend to be less resistant and cause fewer regulatory hurdles, although some are more difficult than others. And, you know, if a rural community throws up any obstacles, it's game over. Nobody's going to invest there. You need to court capital investment if you're in a rural area because it's already a challenge. And there are policies, federal policies like Universal Service and the Rural Utility Service, which I used to head, that provide subsidies or assistance to help get service to every corner of the country, and we need to continue to rely on those.
I think that you've hit on the – I don't disagree with what Jonathan said, except I will say these proceedings are not designed and are not likely to facilitate rollout in rural areas. In terms of your problem, that's an issue for the FCC on the high cost front. And I suppose if you're going to look for a mobile solution, I guess the wireless mobility fund front. But I don't, you know, when we look at the applications that have come in so far, or what we think is going to come in, I guess is the way I should say it, because that hasn't taken place yet. I don't see the federal programs providing you a lot of relief in the near term, sir. The fact is, you make money. You know, these are they're going to have to put a lot of cell towers up, and they're putting them up because they're going to be more people, and they're going to need more capacity. That's much less of a problem out where population density is small. So I'm sure eventually you will get some amount of whatever 5G ends up being out where you live, but you're going to be at the end of you're going to be the last place they deploy. They'll rely on existing infrastructure for as long as they can. That's just the way of the world.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller, for your question. It looks like there are no more questions in the queue. You can press the star key and the pound key if you'd like to ask anything before we finish here. Gardner, is there anything you'd like to say?
I think it's been I don't want to end the conversation early, but I think it's been a fantastic panel, and I know Rob had to drop, but I would like to, while we still have time on the call, to thank both Brad and Jonathan for the heated conversation. I think it was very enlightening to me personally, and hopefully it was to the audience as well. What I'd like to do in the last minute or so here, 2 minutes or so, is, Jonathan, for you to give your final closing remarks. Be sure to give Brad an opportunity to say his final piece, and then we can end the call.
Okay, thanks, Gardner. I just say that ultimately we need to work with localities, and we are trying to bring everybody up to a sort of a high standard of what the best communities are doing today, which is to roll out the red carpet for wireless infrastructure. A lot of folks don't realize, and the gentleman in Southwest Colorado might be one of them, is how challenging the times are for this industry to sort of keep up with the demand. The demand is predicted to go up 500% in the next 5 years, and we've got to build all this infrastructure to keep up with it. Meanwhile, the average monthly revenue per user is dropping from, in 2015, $44 to $41 in 2016, at the same time that users are getting a lot more data for the money. They're making really use of these networks so extensively that the average price per megabit, which is the amount of data they're getting, in 2007 they had to pay a consumer $1.37 per megabit. And in 2016, it's less than half a cent per megabit. I mean, that's incredible. It takes a lot of infrastructure to deliver these massive amounts of data that people are using, and we're getting paid less and less to do it. So we have to build this expensive infrastructure. Then, we have price wars going on. You'll see on television where, Gardner, your company's sawing bills in half, and other companies are saying, well, send us your bill, and we'll chop it down, and we'll pay off your current contract. And these things cost a lot. At the same time, your companies have to spend all of these vast sums on infrastructure deployment. So if you want infrastructure in your community, the smart communities are rolling out the red carpet. They are saying, we're not going to throw a bunch of barriers. We're not going to charge, $3,000 to get on a pole. We're going to give a good deal, and we're going to try to make our rights of way, which are there for the public benefit, really benefit the public by incenting companies to invest in our community. And there is a competition out there among communities. When I was in Arlington, they were thinking about how do we get ahead of some of our neighboring communities here and make sure we get the first dollar of investment. And that's what's happening. You're seeing almost a bidding war. You saw that with Google when they tried to roll out. People said, what can we do to help? How can we get rid of barriers? Not how do we keep them in place? And it's not just the FCC and Congress and the administration that are saying that, and they're all saying that strongly. We need to get rid of impediments to infrastructure deployment. But we're seeing it in states where 13 states have passed laws along the lines of what it is that I'm advocating here. So, the movement is in the direction of investment. The way you get investment is by not throwing up a bunch of obstacles, by making it easy and streamlining your process and inviting investment. because I'll tell you right now, there's not enough to go around. There's no way we can keep up with the demand. We're not going to get to Southwest Colorado if we have to pay $6,000 for a pole in a small town in Massachusetts. It's just not going to happen. So the industry won't pay that. That town will be deprived. Other towns that might be able to demand a high price in more urbanized areas will take the dollars off the table that are needed to get broadband out everywhere. So smart folks are welcoming us in, are saying, how do we make this easier for industry? How do we get our share of the investment so that we can have broadband? Because ultimately broadband is going to improve our local economy. It's going to improve our access to healthcare and education and cultural activities, that I could go on and on. So that's what we're seeing. That's why we're encouraged by all the support we're getting from not only on the federal level, but on the state and local level as well. So thank you for having me here today.
Thanks, Jonathan. Brad, you have the last word.
Oh, thanks. Well, I have extraordinary respect for both Jonathan and Rob. I agree with almost all of what Jonathan said, particularly, you know, if the states want to do it, obviously the state legislature has the authority. I'm not going to, whether the particular legislation is perfect or not, that's what democracy is all about. So I have no problem with that. And he does make a good case, and a very good case, that if you want it in your jurisdiction, you need to be rolling out the red carpet. No doubt about all of those. I think the only place where I seriously disagree with both Rob and Jonathan, and probably my strongest point, is I really don't think that the current law, I don't think Congress intended, I know Congress did not intend this. I was part of the negotiations that led to the 1996 Act. The 253 and 332, I testified on the first version of 332 in 1993. I negotiated like nobody, like gangbusters, on all these provisions and on the reservations of state authority. My big thing is the policy prescription may be right. The problem is the FCC doesn't have the authority, and I say maybe right because the FCC, the federal infrastructure and federal apparatus is by its very nature a very blunt instrument, has a lot of unforeseen consequences. So thank you very much for inviting me to participate. I hope I didn't bore everyone with my comments.
Thank you, Brad, and thank all the participants again, and I'd like to thank the audience for listening in, and I'll turn it back to the Federal Society.
Well, Gardner, on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.